still missing Leo, but sure he'll show up. Let's see. Do we have any questions or changes to the agenda at this point? Not seeing or hearing anything. You have to speak up because I'm...
Just a quick reminder. Can you just remind people who are the voting members just as we go into this?
This will be Brenda, Alana, Leo, and myself.
And myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who did I miss?
Carolyn.
Carol. Oh, that's right. Excuse me. God. I apologize, Carolyn.
Carolyn.
Okay. Do we have any changes to the agenda or any questions?
Okay, I'd like to point one thing out that's a little bit different this time around.
I think folks
might have noticed it, but there's quite a bit of summary. There's quite a bit of information on here. And the concept was to put a bunch of the material into the consent agenda and not walk through it today. And this is something in trying to keep the meeting times down, but still provide the material. So if the material, if someone wants to speak or hear about one of these items, we could pull it. We have the material in the back so we could discuss it, but it's not part of the normal agenda for today. So trying something new.
Well, actually, didn't we? We've had the consent agenda before. We just, I don't know if we've actually done a vote on it. But at any rate, I was going to call for a vote on the consent agenda, assuming nobody has any immediate questions or concerns on this. So do we have anybody who would like to ask a question regarding any of the items on the consent agenda? No.
Leo here, Harry.
Hey, Leo, you made it.
Can you hear? I did. I've been here for a while, and you were looking for me.
No, I couldn't anyway, find you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I look common. I just had a quick question on Antrim.
Antrim, fire away.
It just surprised me. I thought when I looked at the package that the indication was that we rested our judgment that they had met their obligation on their press release. Is there any, like, did they deliver power?
They were actually live at our last meeting. They were beginning to deliver power, I believe. Is that correct, Brian?
Can everybody see the screen?
Yep.
Okay. Yes, the Antrim screen.
Rob, you can go ahead and address that if you'd like.
Certainly. They reached commercial production on the 24th of December, produced power, delivered power to us, and was settled through our ISO New England settlement process. Their production in January through March was at 79% of forecast, which is not unreasonable for an intermittent system. They did report numerous winter icing events that curtailed some production. It appears that it's operating as planned and as expected.
Was their contractual date was December 31st? Is that right?
That is correct.
And how did they deliver a reasonable amount of electricity before December 31st?
Yes.
They met their commercial operation date obligation that was in the contract.
How much energy did they deliver?
321 megawatt hours in December.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions? And hearing none, I would move that we accept the consent agenda and move on to the rest of the regular agenda. Do I have a second?
I'll second. Harry, it's Brenda.
Thank you, Brenda. Let's see. We're going to have to do a roll call here. Or Tom, do we need a ruling on this? Do we want a roll call, or can people just say aye?
I think with that, just say aye. Works, Harry.
Okay. All those in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. We're missing...
Aye.
Aye. Okay, great. Opposed? Hearing no opposed, then the motion carries. So let's move on to the regular agenda. And let's see, Brian has already beat me to the punch here. Brian? Yo, Brian.
Yep. Current events.
Who do we have doing current events here?
Rob's going to walk us through current events.
Okay, great. Rob, it's all yours.
Okay. Thank you very much. The first current event, which happened in February, it was a little more current when the meeting, this meeting was originally scheduled, but it is a big event, so we'd like to talk about it, is that the ISO New England conducted the 14th forward capacity auction. It is for the period of June 2023 through May of 2024. As you recall, the auctions are performed for 3 years in the future. The part of the big news, or the biggest news really, is the lowest clearing price since the capacity market. The clearing price of $2 a kilowatt month is compared with recent year history of $9.50 and then around $7.30 a kilowatt month. So the price has dropped down to $2 now. Despite the low price, almost 34,000 megawatts of capacity cleared, far exceeding, or at least exceeding the target by about 1,500 megawatts. What it says is that there's a fully adequate amount of capacity for NEPOOL, for ISO New England's administered market, with a surplus, and the price is $2 a kilowatt month for it. The co-op does have several small resources in the auction, mostly energy efficiency, and we did our aggregated solar resource, which is based on the members' net metering resources, did not clear, and this was not a surprise because the solar resources do not produce capacity during the requisite time period in the winter time, but we believe we'll receive some monthly benefits from that in the future. And not to get too far into the weeds on it, but after the annual auction, which is what I've just been talking about, there are, the 3 year ahead auction, there are monthly, what's called monthly reconfiguration auctions. We're hopeful that we can get some of the solar resource in the monthly auctions. It's not a big amount, but it was an effort that we've talked with you before about trying to gain value for resources that our members have. Otherwise, this auction will result in about an $11 million per year reduction in capacity costs compared to what we're presently paying. Obviously, very good news for our members because reliability and security in the region and a much lower price for our members. A couple of other items I'll go over quickly. We have spoken to you in the past about a mechanism set up to try to get state-sponsored renewable resources into the auction. In order for these resources, which receive some kind of funding or financial support, which would ordinarily preclude them from being in the auction, there is a special arrangement, but traditional capacity has to retire and move and take themselves out of the market and then make room for the renewable resources. None of them did that. There is no resource traded its obligation out, and there is no room for the renewable state-sponsored resources, which is somewhat of a disappointment, I guess, for the renewable advocates. And it's not clear if this continues in the future. It's not clear if how the state will respond to this. It's a story that to be continued. The other large thing, which has been interesting to watch, is that the the largest plant or the two largest units in New England, the Mystic 8 and 9, were to be retired by the owners, Entergy, but they were kept in for the auction for another year for fuel security. That basically the owner was told you have to stay in. There were financial arrangements made to do that. But it's a reliability issue in Boston. And next slide, please, which is slide number 6. And this is a new slide that you haven't seen before. It's shows the history of two items that are quite important to us: capacity cost in the dark blue or black line, and transmission rate in the brown line. And you can see that in 2007, transmission costs just started to take off and have steadily climbed since then. Capacity costs mostly remained flat from 2007 through 16, and then spiked, which I mentioned a minute ago, and has been on a decline since then. And this is just kind of a visual representation of what's happened over the last 20 plus years, and 25 years really, and thought it would be of interest to you to kind of get a visual about transmission and capacity.
Rob, do you see this as the new norm in terms of capacity costs?
I think it will be the norm until the market is changed. Mm-hmm. The generators in the past, if you can see from 2000, well, really from 1997 until 2017, the generators would come to the NEPL meetings. They've come to the regional community and say, we're not making enough money. You know, you have to do something here. And so, you know, when the price spiked up, the generators thought, great. And people like us that have load and have to pay for it thought, this isn't so great. Not every region has a capacity market. New England obviously does, New York does, and others, but some of them don't. And my take on it would be that there'll probably be a lengthy, maybe multi-year discussion about what to do about the capacity market and about keeping the generators whole. Mm-hmm. And I'll defer to Brian if he has other thoughts, or if Steve Kaminsky's on, other people that watch the markets.
I can add just one little thing to that. If you look at this picture, I'm not sure you guys can see my mouse or not, but this big spiky area here wasn't like based on really fundamentals. It was more like the rules changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't because we suddenly were running out of capacity and we really needed to pay a lot of money for it because people weren't coming in. It was really the kind of the mechanisms that set up with how the rules work were altered a little bit. So it spiked the pricing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do we have any questions from anybody on additional questions? Leo, I recall you had a question on the aggregate solar. Yes? No? Okay. Well, I guess we're all set. Move on to winter purchase. Oh, I'm sorry. Carolyn?
I do have a question. Just, you know, maybe like you'll answer it. Obviously, transmission costs are rising and we don't have control over it, but any comment on what they're trying to do to bring down the cost of transmission from the ISO point of view?
I can jump in on that if you'd like, Rob.
Of course.
And Steve, if Steve Kay's on too, he's been doing some work on this in this area. But there is an effort, it's kind of a transparency effort, where folks are coming together to talk through how do all these transmission-like costs work together. So there's the regional network service charges, which is that picture you see here, and then there's local network service charges as well. And for the most part, the combination of those two helps support transmission systems in the region. So they're trying to pull together this kind of spreadsheet model, really, of everybody does it the same way. So everybody gets to see exactly all the inputs that are coming in to create the costs. That's hoping to shed some light and everyone can see where these costs are coming from and where they might be heading forward. So that's one aspect. The other one is every year there's a public process that we partake in through a consultant, and there's also we can attend those groups if we want to, those stakeholder meetings. But they're in there, that's where they go ahead and they approve transmission investments that the region will pay for. So we all are aware of what those costs are and what folks are looking to get in there. I'm not sure if that helps or not, but.
Yeah, I'll add that there's, can you guys hear me, by the way?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. there's a very extensive process at NEPOOL. Every month there's a meeting of the transmission owners. It's called the Reliability Committee. And projects that are on the docket to get built or were proposed and approved because of another committee's actions, which is the planning committee, saying we need transmission there or some kind of solution. The specific projects do come before the Reliability Committee with cost estimates and schedules, and the committee approves it. And if a particular cost is found to be more of a localized necessary cost needed in the very local area, but doesn't support the reliability of the entire pool. For instance, a project needs to be built out in Southern Connecticut because of a Southern Connecticut problem. It doesn't really affect the reliability of the entire region. Those costs are not in the regional rates. We wouldn't see them in New Hampshire. So it's a very extensive process, but it's like a train you're never going to stop, because there's just I'll just say, in this past month, we at the Reliability Committee, they had a project come up that was to reconductor and replace structures on a line that was built in 1913, and it's a necessary line that runs from the middle of Massachusetts up into Vermont, and really needed for reliability. You got to do those things. They come in with pictures and descriptions of everything that's fallen down and the antique equipment that's controlled both ends.
And I think we could add too, right, Steve, that Carolyn, everybody is really focused on these costs because they are fairly steady and fairly in one direction. So there's a lot of people that are asking lots of questions on this. So
there is one more aspect that I would add, is that the FERC ordered that there has to be now a competitive process for large projects that are not time urgent. So in the planning process, if a future project is identified that's not really urgent, it's supposed to go out to a competitive bid process. And the first one of those competitive processes just happened for a fix for the Boston region with the pending retirement of the Mystic 8 and 9 units. And they got something like 27 bids in. So now the ISO staff has to review all of those and choose the one that they think is, you know, meets the reliability concerns the best and at the lowest cost to the customers. It's kind of a horse race. If they don't get going on it pretty quick, the time is going to come when that project is needed, and it's going to probably default to the local transmission owner, which is Eversource, having to just build what's needed. A competitive process. This is an experiment for us in New England, this first one.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
Do we have any other questions or comments on this?
Harry,
I do.
Okay, Leo, I think was up first, and then was that Brenda or Carolyn?
No, it's Alana.
Alana, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you very distinctly. Leo, why don't you ask your question, and then we'll go to Alana.
It's more a comment. It just amazes me that there's not, looking at the capacity market, that spike, which I think was an administrative spike, as Brian suggested, cost the people in New England 7 or 8 billion dollars, and there's no political backlash. It just amazes me.
Interesting. Okay, Alana?
Because nobody knows it.
Alana, you there?
Yep, I'm here. On the transmission costings over the coming years and the steady increase that we've just been discussing, I'm just wondering if Brian and the team have any recommendations for how we could message this to the members, because members are certainly acutely aware that the cost of fuel's coming down, so therefore, as we know, capacity costs are coming down. But I think we need to be clear about messaging why transmission costs are going up, maybe in just referencing some of the bigger projects in the coming few years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Alana.
Well, that kind of addresses what Leo was talking about, too. Okay, do we have anybody else? All right. Rob, do you have some additional material here?
Sure. And before we get off with that, just a couple quick comments. Steve mentioned the Mystic 8 and 9 plants in Boston retiring just after I said they won't be retiring. My point was that for the auction that was just run, which would be 2023 and 24, the units will remain in operation. But after that, they will be retiring. It apparently gives enough time for people to resolve the reliability issue there. And just to mention, initiatives that we've taken, like the Mobo Solar and the Moultonboro Battery Project, are expected to reduce our costs, our members' costs on transmission. So those are initiatives that we have taken understanding that and having foreseen that these costs will be continuing. That's one of the many reasons that it was a good idea to do those. And I'd like to speak quickly on the winter power purchases and then get off so that we can move along with the rest of the agenda. But the energy prices, natural gas and electricity prices, have reached multi-year lows in the winter. And they're still quite low, but they've entered a period of volatility. Believe it or not, the oil, global price war on oil that has reduced oil price dramatically. You've seen it at the gas pumps and every place else if you buy fuel oil. That has affected natural gas in the opposite direction, because a fair amount of natural gas is recovered from the same wells in the U.S. as is oil. So as the oil price goes down, the oil wells are shuttered, and the natural gas production is potentially going to be reduced. And the forward prices, the future market for natural gas has reflected some uncertainty there. But that being said, looking back over the last year or year and a half, our members have benefited considerably from the declining prices. The winter rate period that we just finished came in about almost $3 million, almost 40% less than what we'd forecasted in rates last August. You're, of course, well aware of this, because we were able to reduce rates for our members for March and April, and felt confident to keep rates flat through the summer. We as always continue to watch the pricing fundamentals, international and national oil prices, natural gas production, natural gas storage, consumption, and exports. New England electricity prices, which are of course much more, well, they're much more directly affecting us. The natural gas pricing affects those electricity prices very directly, but then the electricity is what we watch. We watch the weather and temperature forecasts, and we watch economic data. No one knows quite what the impact is going to be of the current virus issues, but it may have an offsetting impact on the reduction or the expected reduction in production of natural gas. We're sitting with two items of volatility. One is, will gas production dramatically drop or substantially drop, I'll say, and will the demand for it also substantially drop, offsetting penalties if you're a football fan? So that's kind of where we're at. We did make a purchase for the month of May, and it came in about $30,000 below what we had set in rates when we set them at the end of February, or when we had did the analysis at the end of February. Moving on to our colorful graph, we show you this each time, and it has changed some. The main takeaway here is that 2021 and 22 dropped sharply over the winter. You can see at the very right hand side. And as a reminder, this graph shows that at any given point on the let's see, the 16 month period from January 2019 on the left to April 2020 on the right, if you choose a spot and find the year that corresponds with that color, be able to purchase a whole year's amount of electricity. It's called an annual strip of electricity at that price. Let's pick on 2021, which is the green triangle, and it's on the left, on the right hand side, it's the lowest line. In November, that price was over $39 a megawatt hour. And in March, it was down to about $33. So a pretty substantial 20% drop over the winter.
Carolyn, did you have a question?
I did. Rob's point about the oil and gas prices and the fact that you're going to have a lot of the shale gas being shuttered, and some of these things are relatively small, and so you don't know how much is going to come back. Are we actually contemplating now at least locking in, at least during the winter months, going out several years, some of these prices, just in case there is a huge slow return of some of this capacity? In other words, every winter we're going to get, we know we need gas to for the heating, you know, because that's the conflict. It goes to heating and not for electricity. If this is going to be very, very slow coming back,
it's 9 o'clock.
And maybe this is a good time to lock in some of that requirement.
So we have quite a discussion a little bit later about procurement and how we do procurement.
That's fine.
And I'm gonna hold that. I want to hold that for then, but I've got it noted.
Okay.
Gary, I wanted to point one more thing out too, that if folks are following along in their books, some of these pictures might be slightly different. We did update a couple of them, but they're not dramatically different. There's no real content change. It's just, you know, stylistic or something. But if you see something slightly different, that's the reason.
Okay. Does anybody else have questions at this point? I can't see everybody here, so. Okay. Brian, dumb question. are we evolving a strategy here for how we're going to deal with this long-term trend? It seems to me, you know, it could go either way. We could see lower prices or higher prices. I'm sort of curious, are we thinking, how far ahead are we thinking right now?
We're looking, we'll talk about this a little bit too later too, Harry, the okay. same, it's kind of the same, similar to the same question, but we're also trying to add some perspective to this chart because it does show just prices dropping kind of off a cliff since 2019. And we could go back further and show the same thing. But if you look in the little table section over here, this gives you an idea of what actually occurred. And if you were to pick one particular year, let's look at 2016. What this table is telling us is that this contract, your mass hub, if you looked at the day ahead price, which is basically the daily price, and averaged it all together, this is what you would have paid if you just used it. You didn't buy forward, you just bought it when you needed it each day. It would have been $30 for the entire year.
Okay.
And then this year-to-date column, it says, oh, that's great, but you've got some higher priced months in the winter and lower priced months in the summer. What does it look like year to date? Because 2020, we don't know annually. And this says in 2016, from January through April, it was $29, the average. And then you can see in 2020, we're January through April, we are very low in actual prices that are in the market right now. So it's helpful to put these low prices that we see for buying a full year in perspective as to what are they actually costing. So if this one's $33 that Rob pointed out, you can see we saw that in 2017, but it was a little bit lower in 2019 and lower still in 2016. So that was the help. That was the idea of putting this table.
Thank you. Put that in conflict. Just talk about 2015, just so I make sure I understand what the difference between annual average and then average year to date.
Sure. So for 2015, this says if you summed up every single hour at the mass hub, now we buy power at the New Hampshire load zone, so it's two different areas, but they're very similarly priced. Mm-hmm. If you added up every hour and averaged it together, the annual price for that for a 1 megawatt hour was $42. But to put it in perspective from where we are in 2020, we're only through April. So if we wanted to look at what was the price in 2015, if you only looked at January through April,
okay,
it was $72. And that's normally what you see occur, where you have the winter periods are slightly higher, so they bring the average up.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
We're not seeing that this year. That's why the year-to-date column is there.
Okay. All right. Do we have any other questions, or if not, let's keep moving.
Okay. This is another visual representation of what Brian and I have just been talking about. The blue line shows the pricing going back to 2016 for believe this is the month of May, and we are at historic lows. 2016 is a good benchmark year because that's when the low-cost fracked gas started really hitting the Northeast markets. So you can see, even though there's been a little bit of volatility lately in the last few weeks, compared to the last several years, we're at quite low prices. And this is slide 9, by the way, for people that are following. And I didn't have anything more to add to that. And I believe that's the end of my little spiel here.
Okay. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Dave, you're up. Hello, Dave.
Hey, great.
Okay.
Thanks, Harry.
Yep.
And thanks, Rob. So this is just a little overview of what our current program looks like. It's a kind of a combination of different load control, load management end uses, but it's out of 4,400 total installations that we're currently operating, there are about 3,900 water heaters, and then we have 500 other installations that are larger water heaters, which we refer to as storage water heaters, electrothermal storage units, which are the, you know, the heaters with bricks in them, and dual fuel, which is baseboard heat backed up by something like a wood stove or, you know, something like that. So the issue right now is that the hardware, both the hardware, the old switches, which you see a picture of right there, and the software are obsolete, basically. The switches are 20 plus years old. Some, we have some versions that are over 30 years old. And they're actually reaching the end of their life. So they're failing, or they can, they're more likely to fail. And the software that we have from a company called Converge, which is now Itron, is not supported, and it's you know, ancient software. It still works, and it runs the system, but it's just not being supported, and it's old. The program itself is incentive-based, so we have a monthly payment structure where we compensate the members who are participating based on kind of the combination of things that they have under management. But the water heaters only, those that are only doing water heaters are getting about $4 a month currently, $48 a year. So this has been a very good program for us. It's gets right to the heart of the rising transmission costs, and it's because it's peak reduction oriented. So if we want to continue with this program, we need to look at updating both the switch hardware and the control software. Okay, next slide, please. Next slide. Moving to slide 12. Who's doing the slides?
We're seeing slide 12.
I'm sorry, you can't see that?
Oh, we're on slide. Okay, great. I guess I had a delay there. Okay, so the new switches. So, well, just to back up, we've identified a pilot, or we've defined a pilot for this new technology. And the group is about 40 members in Colebrook that actually have, that are currently on the program and have been, but their switches aren't being actually dispatched because the transmitter, the radio transmitter that sends the control signal to the switch, was taken out several years ago. The intention was to move it, but we ran into some licensing issues involving Canada for the radio spectrum, and we're not able to actually reinstall the transmitter at a different location. So they've been sitting there, actually not being operated. So as we approach these members, that gives us the opportunity to actually, you know, get a an operating system there, and allows them to continue with the program. So I've been working with Energy Services and Member Communications groups, Mike Reynolds, Alicia Melanson, and Seth Wheeler, to develop the messaging to go out to the members. It's in the form of a letter. So the reason is that we need to get a written authorization from the member to install this communicating software on their premises. So we've gotten approval from legal for this, and it's all ready to go. All right, next slide, please. 13, yeah. So, of course, the big, you know, issue right now is the COVID delay. So we're, you know, we're basically on hold until we can get into to people's homes. But so the technology, you know, just briefly, the technology is based on a, it's actually a standard communications protocol called OpenADR, and which has a lot of advantages for us that I can go into a little bit. But the one of the basic advantages is that we have vendor independence. Since it's a standard, we're independent both at on the utility side, on our side, the software that's required to dispatch the switches, and then the switches themselves are standard. And so we can basically use anybody's switch, and we can use anybody's dispatch software that's compliant with this OpenADR OpenADR standard. So we're not locked in to a proprietary system, which we currently are. So there will be two configurations that we'll be piloting. One is based on the cell data network, cellular telephone data network. The switch has a cell radio in it, and it will be communicating with the cell network. And the other is based on the member-supplied broadband internet connection. So it will require that the member allow us to sort of piggyback on their internet connection. So the advantage of this is that where there's no cell service, which is the case in certain areas in our service territory, we can use the broadband solution. And then where the member does not have a broadband internet connection, we can use the cell. So we have some flexibility there. I'll get into this a little bit more, but one of the configurations uses a gateway device. And that actually implements, the gateway implements something called Zigbee on the member side. The home area network is established by the gateway, which uses the Zigbee protocol. And then that also gives us the capability to add other devices than the switch, for example, a thermostat. So there, we have additional flexibility there. It can be expanded to include other devices that we can then manage. So, and then one of the real advantages here is that this new technology is two-way. So we can, in addition to being able to send commands to the switch, we can also get data back from the switch. And this can tell us whether the switch is functioning, whether it's online. Give us some feedback, which we don't currently have with the old radio controlled switches. So this will help us maintain the program more easily. Okay, next slide. So this is kind of a confusing diagram, but you know, basically what we're trying to do here is show what the two configurations are. So on the top, you'll see that the member-supplied broadband connection is what we use to communicate. The DROMS is our dispatch platform. That's our dispatch software to send the control signals to the switch. So that communication happens over the internet. And then on the bottom picture, we have the cell network. So basically what's happening is our control software is communicating with the vendor via the cloud, and then the actual controls go out to the switches via the cell network. So we have the two-way communications. We're sending events and we're getting status via this standard protocol. Okay, next slide.
Dan has a question.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
I'm curious about these switches and their current carrying capacity. It seems to me that the same switch that could interrupt power to a water heater could interrupt power to an EV charger.
Yeah. So that's a good question and a good point. The issue with these devices, though, and in particular with EV chargers, which we're looking at very closely, is that there's a whole separate kind of management protocol for EV chargers that is kind of more efficient and effective than a switch.
It depends on what EV charger. What I've got is a Tesla wall connector. It has no intelligence other than it's getting power from the grid and the car is asking for power.
Right.
So yeah. If you interrupted power to it with one of these, that would take care of the simpler chargers. I understand there's fancier ones available.
That's true.
I'm just suggesting that if this device can handle 60 amp switching, it would be a way to today provide both an incentive to the member to have load control and benefit to the co-op to keep my car off of the grid when you need me to not suck things down during a peak.
Right. Good points. I'm just making a note here.
Not to detract from the other of a fancier car charger, but having the flexibility of, since it looks like we have an interesting device here, it could be used for multiple things.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And there's certainly other applications like pool pumps, for example. There's plenty of applications for these, just the switch itself. So here's a little bit about the economics of the pilot. Now, this is just the pilot. We're dealing with a small quantity of devices. I think, the bottom line here is that it does pay for itself. It takes a while, but we are seeing a pretty significant benefit because of those high transmission costs. So we expect the program to pay for it, this tiny pilot program to pay for itself by year 9. We're changing the incentive structure. We're trying a different incentive structure where the incentive is a one-time payment. We're just offering the member $50 as an incentive upfront, as an incentive to participate, and then discontinuing the monthly payment. This is a pretty standard incentive structure that's used in many utilities and seems to work pretty well. It's basically just a come on to get people to participate. So the average installed cost is $275 a switch. That's, again, a very small quantity. The switch itself averages about $200. Installation costs between $50 and $100. There's an additional software charge that we use. There's an additional software piece that we use for testing, for bringing up the program. As we install new units, we can interrogate them and test them. So that'll only be necessary for the time that we are actually installing the units. And we can discontinue it after that. But there is a data charge, a per unit data charge, that's about $20 a year average. That's just to run the communications between the device and our platform. Staff time is about $2,000 a month, and that'll just be for the 2 months to get all the units installed. So the total cost is about $22,000 for the first year, and then about $1,000 a year. So that'll give us an avoided cost, or the switches produce an avoided cost of about $75 per switch per year. So that'll give us a total savings of about $3,000 a year. And that's based on $18 a kilowatt month, basically, over the 10-year period. and that's also based on an average of a 0.35 kW load reduction per switch, which is something that we've measured. That was a number that was provided to us a while back by a consultant, but we've also seen this actually a little bit more. So that's what we're seeing. So now we're on slide 16. This is just the detail.
Could I ask a few questions before we move to slide 16?
Of course.
Just actual questions, because I'm a little confused.
Sure.
When you're talking pilot on this slide 15, are you talking the pilot section for the 40 members in Colebrook or the 39,000? Is this costing already in the budget and approved by the budget? And when you said it would affect transmission costs, I don't understand how that works. Thanks.
Oh, okay, sure. So the pilot is just the 40 members. It's basically just a test of the system to make sure that it's reliable and it's performing the way we would expect it to. You know, and we'll make a decision whether to expand to replace more switches, you know, kind of based on whether this pilot, you know, pans out. So the transmission cost or the avoided costs here are primarily based on reducing our peak that the RNS and LNS. So yeah, this is helpful. If you look at the avoided cost area on this table, what we're looking at is because the technology reduces our peak by about, you know, 0.35 kW per unit, which is, you know, small, but if you have a bunch of them, it adds up. That will, and you hit those peaks, that will reduce the cost that we're paying for both capacity for RNS, which Rob and Brian were talking about earlier, LNS, which is another transmission cost, and IND, which is an additional small charge. Those are all based on our peak each month. And to the extent that we can reduce that peak, we're going to save money on what we would have otherwise paid. So does that make sense?
It does. But how much does the member save on their how does that affect a member's transmission charge or the charges to transmission? And the second question is, does, just to make sure, does, because we're only doing this in Colebrook, do they have broadband?
No. We haven't actually found that out yet. Some probably do, but that's going to be something that we'll find out in, you know, when we start doing the outreach. So the the other question is that the what does the member see? The individual member doesn't see a save. They'll probably see a little bit of energy savings because the switch actually turns off the water heater for a period of time. The water heater won't run. But then when the water heater is turned back on, typically what we see a little bit of spike because the water heater will turn back on usually, typically. So the member doesn't really see much savings. What the savings are passed to the member, you know, the incentive payment is really the benefit to the member. We're transferring some of the benefit that we're seeing from the peak reduction to the member in the form of the incentive payment. But beyond that, the value is to the co-op as a whole because it reduces our transmission charges. And we pass that along in lower rates.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Do we have any other questions at this point?
I
have. Alana?
Just a follow-up. So have you modeled it already in terms of the reduction in the transmission costs once you scale it up? Have you already done all that? Have we got a pretty good idea of that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we've done that done that model. We've actually extended it out to replacing all the switches. So we have that model. What we're seeing right now in terms of the performance is we see about it's about a 2 megawatt load reduction that we see depending on the time of year. Because during the summer, you don't get the heat reduction, but so it's about 1.5 megawatts in the summertime. So we expect to continue to see that.
Is that for the 5,000 units?
Yes.
So that's roughly 1% of our peak demand?
Let's see. Yeah. A little bit more. If you figure 170 for the peak, 175 megawatts is our peak. Yeah. Which is a winter peak. So this is a little bit different. This addresses our monthly peaks, which is what our transmission charges are based on. So this is every month we'll get the reduction.
How successful are we at calling peaks? Because in this scenario, we effectively take the risk. We're assuming we're making the investment. We're assuming we can call the peak. How successful are we? And do we think it's going to get harder over time?
Yeah. So we currently run this program just basically on a timer because we've looked very closely, you know, for this project and for other projects at the probabilities of the peaks occurring at different times. And we've done the assessment over the last, decade, I guess. There hasn't been a lot of change. They occur almost like clockwork, given the time of year. So we've been very successful in forecasting these peaks because basically we dispatch every day. The transmission peaks are have a peak period, which is weekdays. Weekdays are only or when the peaks occur. So we dispatch every day between 5 and 8. And that's, almost with clock-like regularity is when the peaks occur. Will it change in the future? Yes, but are more than likely because, we're not the only ones that are doing peak reduction strategies. All the other utilities in the region have some sort of peak reduction strategy in place, and that's going to modify the load curve. And we're already, I think, seeing that. But we can respond. And in fact, that's going to be one of the real interesting learnings from the MOBO battery, is because the MOBO battery effectively is the same, design impetus. It's to reduce the monthly transmission peaks and also the capacity. And we're going to be very closely watching the RNS forecast algorithms. And we've done a little bit of work internally on doing that RNS forecast for dispatching any kind of load reduction technology, whether it's a battery or, the water heaters or anything like that. Does that answer your question?
It does. The pilot's de minimis. It's a couple $1,000s. Who cares? But I wonder about is whether long term we want to take increasing financial responsibility for calling peaks. Because I believe with the batteries and the load management happening on the system, it's going to get harder and harder in 2028 to call peaks because the curve's going to flatten.
That's a good point. I think there's a lot of people looking at this. You know, we're not the only ones that are looking at this. The peak forecasting is, definitely a great concern to a lot of people. But I appreciate the comment.
Can I just jump in, please?
Absolutely.
I would just note that there's the tiniest glimmer of hope that all of the utilities doing these sorts of programs, chasing the peaks and trying to avoid themselves part of the responsibility, is actually have an effect. Between that and PV, the large amount of PV that's come onto the whole New England grid, it got to the point where at the last Planning Advisory Committee meeting of NEPOOL, the ISO staff was in saying, the 20, I can't remember what future year it was that the plan involved, 26 or 27, it's out there somewhere. But for southeastern Massachusetts, the impacts of these programs and PV coming onto the system and wind have caused the ISO to determine that the regional transmission plan for southeast Massachusetts, which is what we were talking about earlier, that regional system plan has a bunch of projects in it that need to be re-looked at. They may no longer be needed in the time frame of the study. And so they went through a really hours worth of detail about, what were the impacts of this plan project, and they sorted them out, and they said, well, so far we know that like 70% of the projects are still going to be needed for reliability purposes because we found voltage inadequacy here or there, but there's this other 30% or so that they say we think that they might not be needed at all. And so they want to get them off of the building list of the transmission owners and the competitive transmission process if they're not going to be needed, or at least pushed out so that the money isn't spent unnecessarily. So this is like, the holy grail that we've all been trying to get at for a long time, is actually take into account what's going on the system in terms of load reductions and what people can do, and push off transmission projects that don't need to be done. New transmission projects. I won't say, some of the old projects, the falling down transmission projects, you gotta fix them. Okay.
Thanks, Steve. Joan, I believe you have a question.
Let's go
to Joan first and then Carolyn.
Just real quick, since you are going to be out working with members, I assume you're coordinating with either Craig or Mike Licata on member feedback and testing some of the member, the voice of the member platform, et cetera, that's all being worked together.
Yeah, we're working with, Craig's group with Energy Solutions and with Mike's group, Seth Wheeler, on how we message this thing. And, we're certainly going to be very interested in the kind of feedback that we get from the members. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point.
Okay. Carolyn, you have a question?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. First of all, I'm concerned with all these projects that we're doing, that we do the projects, we learn from them, but we don't take them to scale. So when you think, go back to this project when it came out, we got the 4,400 out there. That was the pilot. Presumably, we all thought this was great. And then we never took it anywhere. We never sat there and tried to expand it so that it had some sort of scale to our members. Now what we're doing is we're going to come back and we're trying to say, well, we've got these devices in a group of homes. We need either to spend money to keep them going, and we're only going to get at best maybe a 1% reduction in terms of our peak demand. The money that we have to spend, however, it has a 9-year payback, which is high, but more importantly, it's not NPV positive, all right? So I question that. I also really question the fact that we still have not talked to our members, like Joan was saying. We haven't talked to our members even on the battery storage project. So I'm really concerned about the fact that this is not going to be put to scale. And I'm really concerned about that it's we're not talking to our members in terms of even the battery storage product. And finally, that for this, you know, it's not NPV positive. So that's where I'm coming down on this right now.
Okay. Thanks, Carolyn. We are up against our time break here. So unless we have other pressing questions, let me pose one of my own, which is the agenda calls for a break here. Does anybody need a break or should we soldier on?
I'm willing to go on.
Okay.
Harry, I had a quick question on Dan.
Dan, I'm sorry. I can't see you. I can hear you. Go ahead.
One of my concerns with this project with putting these new switches in is, you know, we're still assuming that the devices being controlled are dumb water heaters that are either powered or not powered. Many new water heaters going in have a lot more intelligence than that and are internet connected. You know, I'm really hoping to see some movement to work with devices that the members have already installed on their own, and so that we aren't paying for the switches to control things, but we are simply sending signals to devices that customers already have, and that would be through a Google or an Alexa or whatever, but perhaps. But I'd really like to hear some discussion, not necessarily today, about moving in the direction of activating devices that customers already have installed.
Okay.
Can I make a comment? It's Leo here.
Go ahead.
I think Dan's comment is interesting, because if I take the $275 or I don't know what it costs us, $300 to do one of these installs, I add it to an incentive for a water heater, I'm almost getting to the point where I can afford to put in a heat pump water heater in each of these homes and give the people a device that's much more efficient than they currently have and be able to control it. And maybe we're not looking kind of big picture enough, because the other alternative I look at is if we just stop paying everybody $48 a month now over the 8-year time frame of the pilot, we save close to $20,000 of member money. So as opposed to breaking even on the pilot. So it's, I don't know, it's interesting.
Yep. Good point. Okay, does anybody need a break or hearing?
Just a quick one for me, Harry.
I'm sorry?
Just a quick break for me. If you don't
okay.
mind.
Brian, go on. So what, 5 minutes?
That would be great, thanks.
Okay.
Let's call it for 5 minutes. That would be at 9:44.
just caught a glimpse of my my 7-year-old's Zoom meeting with her class. Pretty cool. Do we have everybody?
I don't know, but we're almost, yeah, we're on time, so let's get going.
Okay.
It's all yours, Brian.
Thanks, Harry. And thanks, Dave. Thanks, Rob. Okay, so I think we should talk a little bit about the transactive energy rate. We've heard a lot about the transactive energy business model and how the strategic plan is pushing us towards this. And I wanted to talk about a foundational element and how the co-op is looking at it. So I'm on slide 20. And I just threw up here, I just pulled this straight out of the strategic plan. And I kind of highlighted the section on where this transactive energy rate is kind of getting fits in. And it's the pricing signals that we talk about for the transactive energy business model pilot.
Okay.
Here's a graphic that I think everybody's seen because we've used this before, and I think it's pretty popular out there. But it kind of walks through what does it look like with very high DER adoption in a transactive energy business model. And I'm going to get my mouse here. We talk when a lot of times when folks are thinking about the transactive energy business model, we go straight to here, where we want to have neighbor trading with neighbor, and we want to be providing to the grid or the distribution system many different market products. Right now, we are down here with relatively low DER adoption rates. We see the strategic plan pushing us into this mid-tier, this DER integration tier. So we want to start to get down to a distribution kind of platform development in order to accept a transactive energy business model. And the transactive energy rate plays a pretty key role in that. Any questions so far?
Yeah, do we have numbers around what you mean by high and low? So just so that we know what the goal is, if we're trying to get to that transition point on your lovely arrow. Now, how many members need to adopt in order to get into stage two for New Hampshire Electric?
I think as far as penetration rates, I think is what you're asking about, Alana. I think you could look at Hawaii as being a very, you know, high penetration rate of PV systems. The state of Vermont, one of our neighbors, has a pretty high penetration rate. But what I think...
So we've got 81,000 members, Brian. Sorry to interrupt. We've got 81,000 members total. We've got about 70,000 residential. To be moderate penetration rate, what's the number?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I think the one way to look at this maybe a little bit differently is the strategic plan is asking us to move towards something that allows widespread adoption of DER. Doesn't really describe what widespread adoption is, but to help move it along. And I think what we're going to talk about today is the initial stages of that.
But again, I think you have to keep in mind scale. You know, we are doing a lot of work in trying to get this so that we have all the tools. But if we don't ever push these pilots to scale, then we're just increasing costs. Mm-hmm.
Any more on this slide, or should we move to the next?
Let's move along, Brian.
Okay. So I wanted to try to walk through, what are we talking about when we talk about a transactive energy rate? And in this example, we're going to be looking at a 24-hour example that's highly variable. So you've got a different price on each hour. And the idea is that it's a single price that members or third-party aggregators can react to on their own. And then the price is something that the co-op would honor. It could be for a whole home, or it could be just for a single device. So we could take, in this example, we're looking at a battery. And when? In this example, we're saying this price would be updated daily, but that doesn't need to be the case. It could be monthly, it could be hourly. The higher the frequency, it probably gets a little bit more complex for people to respond to it and for the cooperative to deliver it.
Brian, can you hear me? Don't we run the risk in this kind of scenario of basically we're becoming the market because we're buying apples and oranges and we're selling tomatoes. And so because we're pricing tomatoes, but it's not what we're buying capacity and distribution and energy, but we're selling something else, we take the risk that we get the number right. And if we get it wrong, we lose.
So in this concept, I think, you know, NHEC is kind of performing the market maker status. Right? I think that's what you've just alluded to.
Right.
And this, yep. And in this is what we're trying to do is monetize costs, avoided costs, which I get into the next two slides down. Actually, let's hold that to here, but it's on an avoided cost scenario, which we are adjusting on a daily basis. So if we happen to find that the price is not working correctly for the cooperative or we're missing something, that can be updated the next day.
But the horse is already bolted if you miss the peak on capacity or you miss the peak hour, you miss, do you know what I'm saying?
Sure, yeah. Okay, here's a 24-hour example. And please let me know if this is not, I hope this is self-explanatory, but it might not be. So I'm going to walk through what it is for everybody. On the left-hand side, we have month, day, year, hour ending. So this, I picked a day in January where it was relatively expensive. It's January 21st, 2019. Hour ending, which is a weird term, and it's a power term. This means from midnight until 1 a.m. So hour ending one is midnight till 1 a.m. And in this particular case, this price was worth $110 a megawatt hour or 11 cents a kilowatt hour. And this next row where it says battery kilowatt hours plus or minus, this is saying if you've got, in this example, you've got two power walls, of which they have 27 kilowatt hours of total storage. And this particular member has told these two batteries that they want to discharge the battery every day and fully charge the battery every day. So in this case, what's happened is the aggregator or the member or maybe the device itself has gone out to some website or something that they can see the price that the cooperative has published and decided what to do with their dispatch schedule. And in this first one, it's looked at the rate and said these 3 hours over all 24 hours, so this is first 0 through 12 and then it goes 13 through 24. These 3 hours were the cheapest hours in every single day, throughout the day. And if they want to stick with their scheme of charging the batteries daily and discharging the batteries daily, they would choose these 3 hours to charge. And in this example, the transactive energy rate that they would be responding to would show up as a charge somewhere on the member's bill. And we would add these all together as the overall charge. So the member charges the battery, pulling energy from the co-op during the lowest cost hours. And then this further down the third, further along in the day, they've identified the highest priced hours and decided, okay, now I'm gonna discharge and I'm gonna discharge as much as I can, which is got a limitation of only 5 kilowatts per hour. Per battery, so they can only discharge 10, or they would try to discharge all of it at once, but they can't. So they discharge hour ending 18, so between the hours of 5 and 6 p.m., and they do that for the next 3 hours, and they receive a credit. And when you add this all up, you've got a overall credit for the day of $2.20. At its very basic concept, that's what we're talking about when we look at a transactive energy rate. So as far as the framework goes, not the development of the rate or anything along those lines, does this help explain what it is we're talking about? This rate will change on a daily basis and on an hourly basis. So there'll be a new one published for 1/22/2019. Good.
I understand the example. Just a general question. Are you assuming that you're going to allow members to resell at the retail rate, which is the way that solar is done now? And have you maybe comment on that wisdom, given that, you know, in the end, you're still competing against, even for solar, you know, utility scale solar prices, et cetera?
I'm not sure how to frame that question, Carolyn. So in this, if we think about somebody's bill, monthly bill, there would be a line on there somewhere where they'd be taking a transactive energy rate cost or charge. They'd have something signed up on a transactive energy rate, which is optional. No one has to do this. It would be an optional rate. And in that, whatever devices they have charged, whatever devices they have signed up for that rate would be receiving or being charged or credited at these rates.
At the retail rates, yes. So you're giving I guess my only question is, and if we, you're pitting members, you're paying them the retail rate while there's a tension with, you know, how much we could acquire that same capacity if we went to, you know, a generator at scale, whether it be a solar, wind, or even a, you know, whatever. And that's kind of what we run in with the net metering.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the goal for putting this together is to help build a foundation for, let me see if I can make a slide here. For what we've envisioned in the strategic plan. So if we've got a base of a business model, and it's a transactive energy business model, we want to be able to find a price that could be transacted on. And this is that example. This is not, I think what I heard a little bit there was, you might be better off building something larger that would have more better economies of scale and maybe higher member benefit to the cooperative for that one particular project.
Well, certainly that, but I'm just simply saying, you know, if we start off by giving, all the value to the you know, we gave all the everybody gave all the value to the people who put solar on the roof in order to incent it. All right. It's once you've done that, it's hard to bring it back. And I'm just suggesting, do you want to make the same decision again? That's all I'm saying.
Carolyn, if I could follow on to your, what you're saying is we've trained solar people that electricity is worth 12, 13 cents a kilowatt, right, when in fact it's worth 3 cents and the peak hours worth a lot and the 12 peak hours are worth a lot. And we're effectively taking that same strategy here and doing it again.
Precisely.
Yeah. Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're not recommending a particular rate structure yet. We're just trying to illustrate how this would work. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think directly to Carolyn and Leo's follow-up, I think this might help. And if it doesn't, let's keep asking the question because I might be missing it. But in this slide, so on slide 24, it talks about how do we come up with this rate? What does this rate mean? And it's meant to be, you know, technology agnostic and really performance agnostic to the cooperative. So if the generation doesn't show up or the member doesn't curtail at a certain time, the cooperative is indifferent. So it's a full avoided cost concept.
Okay, thank you. Dan, I believe you have a question.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to what Carolyn was saying as well. I mean, so Carolyn, you know, not everybody gets paid a retail rate for their solar today. I generate a lot of solar and I get paid a pittance for it, something closer to the wholesale rate. I would take this time of day pricing that was in the example without a battery today, because it would make a huge difference in my bill. How this works with that example or something like it with solar also present creates some interesting question marks. I think there's a lot of.
Okay. So, Brian, I think everybody's clear that this is a work in progress. We're not trying to set a rate strategy here. We're just trying to demonstrate how it works. Do you want to keep going?
Yeah. So I'm on slide 24 and I'm walking through the how piece. So we talked about the rate itself, how this rate would be, well, how do you get the hourly price? And you would stack up a bunch of things. And on the right, there's a picture that kind of shows what some of these things might be. And really, it's we're building a framework here. The framework can be, in order to have the items going into the framework, I should say, can change. So right, we've got a few different items that we're going into it right now, as envisioned. We've got energy costs, which aren't shown here on this picture, but what we do show is for capacity cost, you know, regional network service costs, those are transmission costs, local network service, sub-transmission, and interconnection and delivery costs, also transmission related. So you throw in all of these buckets, which have different values during different hours in order to build up a price. And should we want to start adding in new things down the road, the framework would allow that so that the rate can change and members can respond, or aggregators can respond, or devices can respond on their own. And I think it's important just to remember, you know, why are we presenting this to you today? So we've got a transactive energy business model that's being required by 2022. That's tomorrow, pretty much. So we got to move along. And we feel like this gives us the most flexibility in meeting this company objective. It's flexible.
Could I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Alana, please go ahead.
Brian, can you explain to us why the regional network service charge kind of tapers off so steeply to 2024 and then flattens?
Oh, sure. So it could be the colors are bad, so it's hard to see. But this bottom one, I think, is what you're referring to, Alana? This is the...
No, the RNS one.
So this middle one?
Yeah.
So that one's actually increasing. So if I had moved this big bar to the bottom, it's going to mirror the picture we had before when Rob was walking through the forward capacity market auction. And then you had that orange line that was continuing to go up and up and up. This is supposed to be this middle tier.
Okay, here. I get it now. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, you went on time. So where are we? Here we are, 2020, 2021, and by the end of the year, build an automated calculation that can pull all these avoided cost components together. 2021, test everything out. There's a lot. This step is relatively, I'm not going to say easy, but we have some experience with it. The next set of steps in 2021 is we need to figure out a way, how do you publish this thing out there so people can actually see it and respond to it? If they do, how do we account for folks? How do we move this through our own accounting system, I should say? How do we verify if folks have delivered energy or they're consuming energy and they're at a device level and not on one of our meters? How do we report this? And most importantly, how do we get the benefit to the members? So there's a lot of steps to work through in 2021. And then in 2022, we want to launch this, ready for prime time. And we think there's a lot of interesting things that could occur with this. You know, Leo talked a little bit earlier about us being the market maker, or at least that's how I interpreted it. But this rate could provide an index for third parties to do their own derivative calculations. So third parties could set up and respond to the price that we're putting out there and develop their own pricing structure. So there's a lot of options. We think this gives flexibility to helping us move forward in the transactive energy business model. I think this is the first, we wanted to show you a really concrete example of what the foundation looks like. And I hope this has achieved that. Any other questions before we move on to portfolio risk management?
Actually, I had a question.
Yeah, we have a question from Joan and a question from Ed. So let's go Joan first.
Yeah, Brian, given the time frame that you've laid out on your past slide here, I also see some more policy questions that the board should be thinking about. And these include what Carolyn was trying to mention about, do we give 100% of the benefit back to the individual member, or is there some socialized overall membership? And correspondingly, currently, to the degree the cooperative takes on any risk, that is amortized over all membership over the following 12 months. What will be our policy on that? And to me, those two are very linked. Third, do we allow third parties to get involved, or do we encourage third parties to take on this risk and get involved? What is the benefit to the membership to allow this, or risk avoidance to allow this? So I think there's some really tough policy type issues that the board really needs to start thinking about, so that you have the answers you need to come up with exactly how we're going to administer it.
Thanks.
Okay, and Ed has a question.
Yeah, Brian, so I followed along with everything. In terms of the example you showed, how does the member know what the pricing is in order to take advantage? Is it a prospective pricing? And if so, that would be how, or is, if it's not, How would the member know to charge the battery for those particular 3 hours and discharge for the later 3 hours?
Okay, I can answer that. I'm just writing down Joan's notes real quick. Percentage of the benefit. Okay, so I can move back to that picture. So we could, I don't know if you can see my mouse or not here, but we could do it. We could update it daily. We could update it hourly. We could update it weekly. The idea is it would be ahead of time. So the member or the machine or the aggregator has enough time to figure out what is the right dispatch that they can do. So to keep it relatively simple, we have fairly good visibility as to what the next, let's say, 7 days look like. If we put together a 7-day, 24-hour forecast, and we stuck it up on some website or some FTP site, secure FTP site, or not even secure, it's public, the member can go to the website and view it. But I don't think that's probably going to be the way something like this would be used, because it would be too difficult. There would be one possibility is there would be some type of polling. A device would be going out to this website and saying, is there new information? What is the new information? And I'll respond on that information and go ahead and develop my own dispatch for the next day. So I think the question you asked is, how does the member going to see this? And the idea is it's going to be somewhere on a web somewhere. It could be on the NHEC's website. And that way they can see it and either build the dispatch on by themselves, or they could have a machine-to-machine kind of connection to go ahead and develop and work out the logic to figure out the dispatch. There are some products out there that do this already, so that I didn't try to make that sound like it was some fantasy in the future. There are things that do this already.
Thank you.
Leo here, a question? Hello?
Hey, Leo, I think Harry's trying to...
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had my mute on. Dan had a question, and then I think Leo was next. So, thanks. Sorry, Leo. Didn't mean to step on you. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a comment. I was just reading an article yesterday that Tesla has a bidding software system that they already are using in Australia that they are looking at deploying to power walls and control of power walls and so forth. So the vendors of the batteries may well jump into this space. And Tesla looks like that's a real good bet given their approach to this.
Okay, Leo, I believe you're next.
Yeah, I think back to the way we looked at the analysis of the investment in a battery at Moultonboro. And we didn't look at it at a blended rate where we're just arbitraging day night, as you'd have to do in this model. What we did is we looked at the discrete components that make up our avoided cost. And the reason for that is we only want to cycle that battery as few times a year as possible, probably 20 or 30 times. And I question whether we're giving the right signals to our members in this model. And also that I actually think what we're doing is we're not taking the full opportunity to deliver energy to our members at a low cost in off-peak hours. I think people should be charging cars at 4 cents a kilowatt hour. I think they should be using heat pumps and storing at 4 cents a kilowatt hour if they avoid those peak hours. And we're missing that opportunity by effectively taking the capacity in the RNS and averaging it into spreading it over all kilowatt hours as peanut butter. Thank you.
Thanks, Leo. Do we have any other questions for Brian at this point?
One thing I would like to point out on this is that this is a, if we think of this as a framework, what gets jammed into that framework on an hourly basis can be developed or altered at a later date.
Okay, well, let's, are we done with that in your thinking, Brian, or
I think
you have
so.
Something else you wanted to add? Barry? Okay.
And
unless anybody has questions, we are right on time, pretty much. Moving on to resource portfolio risk management, our third meeting on this. And as a preface, Brian and his team have been working pretty hard to try and answer some of the fundamental questions that have been coming up over the last couple of meetings. So hopefully we're going to have more information here and hopefully answer some of the questions that we've had from different committee members, in particular addressing some of the levers underneath the aggregate numbers that have been reported. So with that said, Brian, it's all yours.
Thanks, Harry. Okay, here's just a simple graphic just to remind folks where we've been. We started off back in May last year, and we went and walked through just, what is settlement? How does it work? Why are we talking about this? It was just to give a foundation on how does energy move through our accounting. We were going to have our second meeting in September, but we punted that to December due to needing a vote on the Moultonboro battery project, if you remember. And December, we walked through, once we had settlement figured out, we moved through what are the objectives and what are our current practices that we do today. And we walked through those. And then COVID came along. And that was going to be our third meeting in March, and we punted to today. And today, we're going to walk through coverage terms and targets again, risk identification, and reporting requirements from our board, from our policies. And as Harry talked about, try to address some of the questions we've been hearing and get the committee comfortable on those questions, on the answers to those questions. And a lot of them come down to identifying risk. And I hope that meets the objective today. So here's four primary things that we're going to go through for this third meeting. We'll walk you through the process that we use to procure energy. So we did this in December. We'll just do a quick reminder on it and what the calendar periods and terms are. And some changes that we're going to be putting in place on those items and why. And then we'll walk through some questions that we've heard. And then hopefully identify these areas that are commonly associated with risk. And we wanted to highlight where all this information lives. Where does the data live that members or directors can go to be fully informed? And then finally, is this meeting the need? Should we revisit the dashboards? Is everybody getting the information they need to do their jobs? So let's jump into it. So this looks, I'm on slide 29. This should look familiar. We talked about this in December. But our theme is diversity and flexibility. This is a picture that we used to show every month. I think every month. It might have been every quarter. But it shows all of the different resources that we have within our mix, and then how does it meet the overall loads? So we have today, we have a combination of kind of market products, so bilateral contracts with folks, unit contingent contracts, and some longer term stuff. Here's what we're doing today. This should look familiar. We have three buckets and three time frames. And two of these buckets are put into, I should say it's a little bit different. It's two buckets and three time frames. Peak months, high shoulder months, low shoulder months. And we look at weekday hours and weekend and hot and night times differently. And that should become apparent in the next couple slides. So volatility. What's one of the reasons you go into procurement? It's to remove some volatility risk, price risk. This picture, I think this picture is pretty illustrative of where do prices move. And we use this picture to identify how can you make some actions based on all the information you're seeing here? And that's on the next slide. But to walk folks through what does this picture look like, on the left-hand side, I've got dollars per megawatt hour. And then I've got on the vertical axis, these are the price in dollars per megawatt hour. And then on the horizontal axis, we have the month of the year. And if we were to pick on the month of January here, this says that over the last 5 years, 2015 through 2019, we saw the lowest average price for the full month of January, not hourly, the full month, was $40. And then if we saw what the price was in January, the highest price we saw for that month in the last 5 years was $110. And then the average price is this middle one here, right around $60, a little over. So that's what this chart means. But the takeaway here is very low volatility in the, you know, May, June, July. Prices have been fairly stable. Winter periods, not so much. Winter periods, not so much. Now, again, this is not hourly. This is monthly. So you add up all the prices in the month, average them together. Okay, so you can develop something that's actionable off a picture like this. And that's what this does here. I'm on slide 32. And this is walking through of those three time buckets on the bottom. So the legend here shows that the weekdays is the blue with the triangle. Weekend days is the orange with the circle, and then nighttime is the square in gray. And this is a relatively simple calculation to determine volatility. There's no math, there's no magic going on here. It's just the absolute value of the max minus the average and plus the absolute value of the minimum minus the average over the last 5 years. And that's your definition of volatility here. So 100% volatility. So 0% volatility is saying that The average price, the max and the min and the average are all the same. Okay. What we've done here is we've developed three tiers for each of these different price buckets. And it says whenever there's high volatility, we'll cover at a higher rate. So we'll have more price certainty as to what those costs will be when we enter into the month. As we start to drop down in the volatility risk, we'll cover a little bit less because the risk of the price moving further away from the average is less. And then the same when we get down below 50%. You can leave more, less, you can cover less here. So I've identified three different tiers. So this top one, 95% forecasted coverage. So of the loads we expect to have, we should cover 95% within a year's time period. And we'll talk about term in a minute, or actually in a couple minutes. And then tier two, we'll drop that down to 80% forecasted coverage. That's in this big band here. And then tier one is 70% forecasted coverage. So this is a driver that can be adjusted on any given five-year time frame to help, from a data perspective, influence how you measure, how you meet your volatility, your price risk from volatility. This is what that looks like in a table. Right, so weekday hours, what's a little bit different from what we saw before is we've taken all three buckets and we've separated them out. And that's because there's a bit of a difference when you go back to that slide, and I'll bounce back there in a minute, where you want to monitor, you might, some of those risks, the volatility risk moves into that first tier. So we have weekday hours, 5 by 16. 5 by 16 just means it's a normal term for energy. It's 5 days, 16 hours per day. That's what that means. So it's 16 hours per day. Those are the weekday hours. And then weekend is 2 days, weekday, weekend day hours, 2 days, 16 hours. And then evening hours is every night hour throughout the week. Seven days, 8 hours of nighttime.
Brian, could I ask a quick question?
Sure.
The coverage target here, is that at the beginning of the month or at the beginning of the rate period?
Beginning of the month.
Okay. I see that as being you're committing to a sell price at the beginning of the rate period. That's the part, the point at which you become uncovered. And I think that's the part, the point at which you need a target, not at the beginning of the month.
And I think we can, I'm hoping to address that question a little bit later, Leo, because that's one of the ones that we tried to in the kind of the question section.
Okay.
So if I hit that and I don't, let's revisit.
I also have just a comment. Mm-hmm. I'm used to seeing these type of limits done also in terms of absolute risk. So there is also a dollar limit that management has agreed to take on that helps set the policy. And these are just percentage. I would put to you that the dollar amount is not equal.
Okay. Joan, we've broken that into two separate areas. So these are volumes, and I've moved the dollar amount piece to more of an authority level discussion. Does that help?
We'll see.
Okay. All right, should we move on?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Okay, and then so here's another level of term and volume. So these two play together. And I'm just going to describe the table on the bottom. So short term, we're identifying as less than a year, less than 12 months. Midterm is 1 to 5 years. And long term is greater than 5 years. And the way to read this, I think from a director's view or a manager's view, would be, okay, this is telling me that in the short term, less than 1 year, I will be at a minimum 40% covered at all times in every month, minimum forecasted coverage for 1 year. Midterm, no more than 45% covered up to 5 years, but no less than 20% covered. In long term, greater than 5 years, okay to have some zero coverage, but do not go over 25%. Does that make sense? So when we talk about this one up here, this slide, this is your short-term one. So moving into this 12-month period, and it could be any 12 months, it could be February to January, March to April of the next year. Or I'm sorry, March to February. I had 13-month years. You would be at no time less covered than 40%. And then this comes up quite a bit on a concern of major member migration. So we're in a competitive supplier state, and that competitive supplier, we could have loads move back and forth. So we wouldn't want to cover for loads that aren't actually there. We haven't found that to be the case. It's been relatively sticky, but the concern is there. So this helps address that. So any questions about the way we will be procuring power from a volume perspective?
Leo here. When we talk about, say, midterm or long term, the idea that we've procured, in my mind, is not risk mitigation, but risk assumption. Because we don't have any commitment from folks that they're going to buy. I mean, we've seen price of oil go negative. The world is a very volatile thing. So I think, and our competitors are effectively buying 100% in the short-term market. Would you agree with that?
Which part?
And so we're competing with somebody who's going to market every year or every month or every day, and we're committing to buy long-term. And so I see that as assuming risk.
Yeah, this is Dawn. I just have, I understand Leo's questions, and I think I'd also point out that this table is not static. It needs to be tied to what we're seeing happening in our membership and how they are taking their power. And I don't know what your criteria was based on. I mean, we have very low mitigation migration right now. But that won't always be true. So there needs to be a tie into what is happening. The other comment I have is our long-term purchases, greater than 5 years. It was my understanding that the purchases that we are making is because of our commitment to renewable sources for the long-term. They are not to cover, necessarily just cover load, but also commitment to renewable energy resources. And I don't see that folded in at all into this table. So I think There's other areas that need to be woven into your story here.
Yeah, so this is a specific to energy procurement policy. Not a renewable portfolio standard or renewable energy credit strategy or a capacity strategy, which is also a need of the cooperative. This is strictly energy. And we'll talk a little bit later about what portion of the cost is associated with energy. On the renewable, the longer term, greater than 5-year procurement that we've been doing in the past. So we do have quite a bit of this. Well, I'm not going to say quite a bit. We'll show on the reporting later that it's like, I think it's like 14-15%. A lot of that, Joan's right, that a lot of that is due to wind contracts that we've been put in. There's some additional contracts in there as well. Landfill gas, which also was put together for the renewable energy credit value to meet our RPS, but in order to keep those projects at a, I don't want to say fair price, but in order to help the developer create that project or keep that project going, the cooperative purchased many different products from the resource over a longer term, including energy, in order to make sure that the project was viable. So in that, a way to look at that is the way this long-term row is put together, you wouldn't do more than 25% of your expected volume over greater than 5 years to help mitigate against the concern of member migration, which I think Leo brought up earlier. Risk assumption of the load not being there with the asset. And that's another explanation I think that's helpful to go into, is that the cooperative is purchasing an asset that has value, whether or not it's used to meet a member need, because we are part of an ISO. So the energy value that we've agreed to purchase, should it not be needed to meet our members' needs, all load migrated away from us, to make an extreme example, that energy would be sold at market, and there would be the risk assumption would be the variance between whatever you agreed to purchase and whatever the market price was at the time. Okay. Oops. Was that everybody, Harry? I didn't want to just move on.
Hey, Harry, you're on mute if you're talking.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying, I don't have anybody else lined up in the chat bar, so we can go right ahead. Thanks, Tom. Sorry.
So at the end of the presentation, we will be looking just for a kind of a show of hands from the committee, from the committee members, that we want to have this all be identifiable in the enterprise risk management plan. So in 2020, the cooperative is walking back through this. And I think we do this every year. I don't want to misspeak on that, but I think we do. I know from a department perspective, we look at this on an annual basis, but I think this year we're going to do a deeper dive. And we want to put, as part of that annual review of the enterprise risk management plan, these portfolio purchase coverage targets will be in there and easily identifiable, as well as, which we're not going to get into in detail today. We had, Harry and I had talked about doing this, but it felt like too big a lift for today because we could have gone off and it could have been a very big discussion item, which is something that Joan mentioned earlier about authority levels, portfolio purchase dollar values. And in that one, it's like, well, what I mean by that are the authority levels are at what level does the department make a decision? At what level does the CEO jump into the decision? At what level does the board jump into the decision on how procurement is being done for the cooperative? What I went over today is the practice we're using on volume and coverage targets annually, or every day, every month we're doing this. This does not address the dollar value that Joan had talked through. But what we'd like to have is both of these in the 2020 ERM plan this year. A listing of the tables that we use for that are coverage targets, and then also the authority levels. And what that allows is on an annual basis, those are going to be looked at, because I think we look at the ERM plan on an annual basis. So that's the vote that we're hoping to have at the end of this. I'll pause there for a minute.
Yeah. Does anybody have any concerns or about that? Okay. Let's keep moving.
So here's what we talked through today. So we use, this is just a quick summary of what we just walked through. We use a combination of energy resources to achieve diversity and flexibility over different time periods. We're using a data-driven process to determine when price volatility is likely to be the highest, and we've developed coverage levels based on that. We've identified what are the minimum coverage amounts for future years. And this creates opportunities for longer term purchases if we find some. And we've identified a spot for directors to go to identify what those coverage terms are and what, as we're proposing, what authority levels are in the enterprise risk management plan. And we're going to talk about, in a little bit, we're going to talk about how to see how those are, how we're doing towards those goals in a minute. Actually, the next section. Okay.
Okay.
So if we jump into, how are we doing on time? Is everybody all right with?
Yeah, we're a
natural breaking point if we wanted to or not.
Anybody need a break?
Okay.
I think we're good.
So, Harry and I pulled together some questions that we've been hearing, and I hope we've identified them okay. I hope some folks had some time to go through the presentation earlier, but please stop me if I'm not getting to the question that you think we're trying to get to here. And I think this is great. These questions are great because they really highlight where are the areas that the committee members feel there's risk associated. And how are we dealing with those risks? Okay, so I'm on slide 38. Risk identification is how we titled these. But the takeaway from this slide is, how big of an issue are we talking about here? What are we talking about? We're talking about energy procurement planning. So that's not capacity procurement planning, transmission planning, renewable portfolio standard requirements or obligation planning, strictly energy. And energy represents about 22% of the overall bill. So when a member looks at their bill, 22% of it in 2019 went towards energy procurement, energy costs. In 2018, that was roughly 23%. Okay, so that's the size of, I was trying to identify, like, what is the size of this risk that people are associating with energy? And we're going to look at this as about 22% is the full value.
Hey, Brian.
Sure.
I actually think that when you look at that, the risk we have is where the members have a choice. And they don't have a choice in the distribution. So I think I'd cut the distribution out of that picture and double the numbers up above it. if that makes, do you follow what I'm saying? And in fact, some of those, they don't have a choice in either. I would guess transmission is a given. We competitive supply pays the same as a co-op. Is that right?
I think that's one way to look at it, for sure, Leo. This perspective was more about a member cost on an annual bill.
But your risk is that the member says, I can get a better deal.
So you broke up there at the last.
Oh, I'm sorry. I say your risk is that the member says, I can get a better deal. And.
Okay.
They can't get a better deal on transmission or distribution. They can only shop energy and capacity.
Right. Okay. So if I don't answer that question later, on because I would view that
it's just
question.
It's just a thought. I'm not saying your numbers are wrong. It's just a different way to look at it.
Sure. But I think what Leo is identifying is a concern of, I think this is load migration again. So if a member decides not to take co-op power and they decide to move to another competitive supplier, Leo is identifying a risk associated with it. And if I don't get to that later, please ask me to address it. Okay. Anything else on this one? So this was meant to walk through the size of the risk that we're talking about. And there's going to be some different interpretations of this table. Okay, this one I think makes sense, right? Is, well, wait a second, power supply is a very big number. You know, we talked earlier about 22%, but that's $31 million. That's a lot of money. What happens if energy prices double, as an example? And we've seen this table before when we started off on this journey, I think back in May. I've updated it. That back then we were using 2018 information, and the picture was basically the same, but I've updated it for 2019. And there's a couple takeaways here. And I've tried to highlight them by circling them on the picture. So for coverage, if we look at our current coverage targets, our target is 76%. We didn't quite achieve that in 2019. We only got to 74. But we got close. So I'm down here at this bottom on the right-hand picture. The left-hand axis is millions of dollars per year in the year 2019. And then there's a lot of information in these bars. The bars represent, if I look at the 74% coverage piece, is if energy prices were double what they were in the energy market, this would be what we would have paid. Right around 36, 37 million, I think is what that's showing, the top of this bar. If energy prices had been 50% or they'd been half of what they were, our prices that we would have paid for that particular year would have been roughly 27 million. So that's what this bar is showing.
That's all because we were roughly 74% covered.
Yes, exactly. So because we had a fairly high coverage value, a very large increase in power prices over the year of 200%, a doubling, would have increased costs, I wouldn't say insignificant, it's a lot, it's to 37 million or so. So there's still some additional cost because the price has doubled, but because of the coverage ratio, it hadn't gone hadn't gone as high as you might think. This little diamond is our overall costs for the year. I think I should have had that number written down. I don't have the note on there, but it looks like to me it's 29 million. And that's going to be full on power supply costs, I believe. So this is saying that there's a variance of $9 million if prices were to double or they were to half, which is, these are pretty extreme examples. We wouldn't expect that to happen over an entire year, but it does show that this is what the impact could be. The two other pictures show what happens if you had no coverage and what happens if you just had that long-term coverage and you stopped doing market purchases. So that, we talked about those longer-term contracts that we're already in. I tried to show what would that look like if we decided to not do monthly procurement any longer, but we still had to keep these because these are commitments we made some time ago. So the takeaway here is if prices were to double, the member would have seen, and I didn't explain this 4% piece, the annual increase on the cooperative bill for the member would be roughly 4% higher if energy prices doubled. So that's compounding the 22% that we talked about earlier. So is there any questions here? What I wanted to highlight is because we have a procurement process in place, the cooperative is protected from high prices impacting the member in a double-digit way, a double-digit percentage way.
Ryan, going back to that 4% number, if our average cost was here at 29, I'm in the middle stack bar in the diamond, 29, and you said that if the prices doubled because we were 74% covered, they'd go up to 37. 37 minus 29, that's a 27.5% price increase. So how do you get 4%?
So I believe what we would need to do with that question, Carolyn, and I could give you the table, and I probably should have had the table here to address this question, but it's saying that the energy price, remember, the energy price was roughly 22% of the total. So 22% of the total increased from about $7 million. And that overall increase over the full bill worked out to 4%.
So again, just a comment, this whole thing is predicated on us amortizing that cost increase over all members over the next 12 months. And that construct needs to be challenged.
Can you say, I want to make sure I understand that. Wait, Joan, would you mind making that one more time?
Right now, if we over or under collect, we just amortize that delta over the next 12 months in the energy charge rates. Going forward, is that a policy or a benchmark that we can sustain? And I'm questioning that construct.
Right, okay. So if I understand that, the question is, If we set a rate ahead of time, because we're not setting rates monthly, we're setting rates on a 6-month basis, and the prices are different than what we had assumed in rates, we'll need to take that variance and adjust future rates because of it, right? And the question is that the best way for the cooperative to be setting rates?
And I'll add a little bit to that because you've got the next slide, which is a picture. And The point is, in the slide, you sit there and say, well, if it does work, if prices do go up, we'll just pass it on. It's a pass-through. And it's that attitude that we treat this whole business as a pass-through when in fact, it's a huge piece of our members' bill. Our members don't look at these costs as pass-throughs. They just look and say, my bill is going up unsustainably. Nobody else pays these types of rates outside of New Hampshire. Looking at this as a pass-through, I think that attitude has to change. And again, back to what Joan said and what I said.
Keep in mind that as we go forward, we're going to have a bigger dichotomy of members and their skill set, their ability to tap into different rate structures or distributed generation. So just amortizing some of these changes over all members is not necessarily fair going forward. And there are competitors will not treat any over or under recovery as pass-throughs. They're going to be managing to a tighter bandwidth, and that can put us at a competitive disadvantage and losing more members or just not serve our members well.
Especially as markets become more volatile, that there are traders love volatility. And so there will be people looking to take advantage.
So I heard three things there. Is it overall process? I just want to make sure I grab these so that we can chew on them afterwards and maybe address them at the next meeting if they're not being addressed fully today. One is the overall process that we use when we're setting rates, kind of the concept of the over-under and how that works, and should that be something that we look at to change in the future? The other, I think, can be boiled down to load migration again, the risk that it's a possibility that loads could migrate away from the cooperative and there might be a concern with that. And that also addresses the competitive disadvantage question. Oh no, I'm sorry. The third one was, I believe Carolyn raised it on, a higher level than risk than what I've been showing you from these first two slides is still soon. Okay. I'm going to move to Carolyn. I'm going to move to the next picture, and I think somebody's trying to get a hold of me. Okay. I love this picture. Seth gave me this. This picture highlights the assets of the company. It's people and its distribution lines pretty nicely, I think. in this particular one, I wanted to address the risk of, okay, let's go back to that and just say, okay, forget the 74% coverage policy. Let's go to the 12% increase in the bill. No coverage. How does that impact the financial health of the cooperative? Is this, How does that impact the financial health of the co-op? So the main part of the company basically is kind of broken into two parts. And we've talked about that before. There's a power resources side that does the energy and the capacity and the regional access charge, those items. And then there's the distribution rate, which recovers costs to support all the assets, most of the assets in the company. It's people, it's buildings, it's trucks, it's distribution system. And we talked about the pass-through charges going through every 6 months. And I wanted to highlight that there's no income statement impact from power resources activities and minimal balance sheet impact from those as well. So the help, what I wanted to walk through with the committee is that when folks think about the health of the cooperative, what would a higher priced energy bill, how would that hurt or benefit the cooperative? And from most folks, when they think about the health of a company, they go right to the financials of the company. And I wanted to highlight that there's very minimal impact on those financials.
But there is. There's a huge impact on the balance sheet because we have to keep an A-rated balance sheet in order to make the, you know, tens of millions of dollars of power purchases. And if we, so that's one big risk. And the second risk, obviously, if you know, some of that power commitment went away and we were still holding the purchase, even though we could sell it, but
you're assuming. So this is Carol, if I can capture that, you're saying the risk is in the rating of the company because we use that rating in order to secure our monthly purchases.
Well, not only that, but we, you know, we're using the power of the balance sheet to manage the cash flows. You know, we were writing checks for $57 million here, $1.23 million there, in these power purchase contracts. That's real cash flow that's flowing through the cash flow statement and the balance sheet. And to the extent that we don't get those anticipated cash flows or they're delayed, that is a huge balance sheet impact.
Oops, sorry. So if we walk through, say a high cost period, that high cost period doesn't get to the balance sheet, which then doesn't, so a high cost period from the power resources side doesn't get to the balance sheet, and then it, so then it wouldn't impact the overall rating of the company, which we're depending on. It's a big circle, which we're depending on in order to make sure we can get good competitive rates out in the marketplace.
But Brian, if you look at the most extreme power purchase the co-op's ever done, it bankrupted the co-op. And so you can't say it doesn't affect the balance sheet, or it's that we don't present it in the balance sheet in the P, or we don't present it in the P&L, but it is a major part of the business.
You have to look at it from a cash flow statement. Okay, we don't show the cash flow statement, but the cash flow statement would start off with saying, you know, we've got these huge power resource commitments coming in every month through the cash flow, and we have to have the cash available to pay that. If we didn't have that cash flow coming in for some reason, we have to rely on the balance sheet and the ability to borrow in order to cover it. It's the cash flow statement and the balance sheet and the income statement that creates that A rating. So the risk is in the cash flows and the huge amounts of cash that are going through it.
Okay. I didn't address the overall cash flow sheet. That's where the over-under gets impacted from that. And that would be the same on the distribution side, right, Carolyn? So if we're having a hard time collecting, it's unlikely folks would be paying just one part of the bill and not another part. That's a question. I want to make sure I understand it. So if we're not receiving enough of the income coming in, then that's going to impact our overall balance sheet.
We are dispersing through the cash flow statement quite a bit of money. All right. If for some, goes back to the question, if for some reason somebody went off and did another a power contract, okay, that we're using the balance sheet to support the fact that we get reasonable terms to buy the power to begin with. That's point one. Point two is we're using the cash flow and the balance sheet to support those power purchases, which are quite large in amount.
It's 11 o'clock.
Sorry, computer. And that's where the risk is coming from. It's not so much that we're not going to get paid. It's this over and under assumption that we are assuming that goes across all 12 months. And it's also the fact the size of the balance sheet commitment that's being utilized by Power Resources. And there's no assessment of the risk of that.
Okay, so I don't think that's accurate, but I'm going to take that back and try to get back to you to see if maybe I'm not presenting this the way that I'm trying to walk through that the overall health of the company isn't significantly impacted from the power resources side of the business. That's the point of this slide. Okay. Next slide. I hope these are helpful because these are the questions that I think we're getting to, but we're getting deeper into them, which is good. So this is back to price spikes, a concern. So we've talked through overall price increases and how that would impact the company and how that might impact a member's bill. And we've talked about coverage. But one of the questions is, what about when you make that coverage purchase? And this graphic is supposed to highlight that, where we've got particular periods of the year where we create, we develop our rates. It's in March and September. And that's identified by these orange arrows here. I get my mouse back. Oops. There it is. Okay. So here we are in March. And this on the left-hand side is what was the daily energy price during that period. So this is what you actually, this is not a forward price. This is what the actual energy price is for your load. Okay. And then here you see this big price spike. And we're going to talk about that earlier, a little bit later in the next couple slides. But this price spike shows a daily price spike. It went up very quickly, came down very quickly, didn't last for the entire month, but was still a price spike and looks concerning. Okay, I'm on slide 41. Moving to slide 42. So this is what happened in that particular period. So in early October, so the rates were set in roughly September, mid-September. And let me explain the graph, the two graphs really quickly. On the bottom axis, the horizontal axis, you have the time of the year. When during the year are you? On the left-hand side is the percentage change for when you set the rate. And the percentage change is for the forward price contract that we're talking about. So in this particular graph, we're talking about the purchase for November 2019. So when we made that rate, the November contract, this is the price movement in the November contract. I hope that makes sense. So as we're moving along, the rate was set, and then that November contract actually gets more expensive. And then it drops down to less expensive in October 31st is when we made that purchase. And the question that I believe is going to be raised here, and this reason I put this here, was, well, the price went up above where the November contract we had planned on paying for. Why was that not created? Why was that not purchased? And this wasn't purchased in October is because this particular period, this price increase here was due to an October, I believe it was cold, due to an October, stronger mix of heating and cooling needs in October. So there's a price disruption here because of weather in October, nothing to do with November. And this bump, you can kind of see, moved forward. Now I'm over here in the December contract. That moved forward all the months. So the energy market was reacting to a increase in or a colder period for a near term in forward months. So the purchase wasn't made because it wasn't a November concern. It was an October concern. And then we went in, and then I'll walk through what we did for December. In December, this is where we started at the rate. We walked through, you see there's that same bump that's going on because of the October weather. And then prices dropped fairly significantly, and the purchase was made in mid-November for half the month, and then the rest of the month was purchased right before the holiday. Because holidays are fairly uncertain periods, and we didn't want to go into the holiday without having the purchase made for December. So I just wanted to walk through how do we look at this on a monthly basis. Any questions there? But the one of the main takeaways I wanted to talk through too was we try to set rates in shoulder periods where things are relatively calm historically. And this picture also helps to identify the risk of high pricing that we've heard today. And for the most part, risks of high prices will have been occur within the month, not prior to the month. So the immediate price that you need to pay for, not a forward contract, but the price that you actually need to pay for your load, what you're settling against, is going to be in a within a month's period reacting to a temperature disruption, a disruption with a transmission line going down, something occurring within the month that causes the price to react. Because you've made a purchase prior to the month, you will not be impacted significantly, depending on your level of coverage, by that price spike. So what I was hoping to walk through here is that increases in prices often occur within a month due to a specific event for that month, weather-related, generation-related, transmission-related. And we try to set our rates during calm periods during the year. And then I walked through an example of how we procured power for that particular price spike. So I'll pause there because I've been talking too much. Okay. I can move on to the next. Any questions on that? So the question was about what if you don't purchase in time and prices increase? And I walked through what happens. This question has come up. I can't see people's hands either, Harry, so if there's a question, you know. So this question comes up. We've touched on this one a few different times. And it's like, okay, you've walked through when power is being purchased, you've walked through at what levels that power is being purchased, and you've walked through the terms that you're gonna use to make those procurements. But what if that all fails and everything, and there's still increased prices during a rate period? What happens? So this is a picture that kind of shows that, because if, unlike what we just did where we reduce rates because prices were coming in lower than expected or planned, we can also go the other way and increase prices if we need to. So in 2014, we had to increase our prices twice. Significantly cold weather occurred. I think everybody can remember the term polar vortex. I had never heard that before 2014, or it just wasn't in my psyche before then, but everybody was talking about it back then. And it was a period of sustained cold in the region for a long period of time, very abnormal. It doesn't happen all the time. So monthly prices were quite high, and that has a compounding effect in the wintertime. So if you have very, very cold periods, your loads will increase. So your coverage ratios that you thought you had when you went into the period were not as high as you would have liked, because your load forecast wasn't assuming that you would have extremely cold periods and needing a lot of load. And then at the same time, to compound that additional need for energy, the energy prices are stressed, or the energy markets are stressed, because a lot of our region is dependent upon natural gas pretty highly. So a lot of that natural gas is being used to heat people's homes because it's cold. So not as much is left over for the generator plants to fire off and create energy. So you start to get up to higher costs generation. And when you do that, the price starts to go up. So in this particular, I wasn't around for 2014, but we decided to adjust our rates twice during that period. And this is the result. You saw this picture with Mark Dean's great presentation on default service rates last board meeting. This is the same picture. It looks slightly different, but it's the same information. This shows the pricing in 2014, the average price for the co-op power or default service rates for the other utilities. And in this period where the pricing got dramatically higher, and we increased our price in 2014, the rest of our neighbors did the same thing. And you can see that even during this period, the co-op was able to remain one of the lower default service providers in New Hampshire. Is there any questions on this? Okay. All right, so what did we do? We walked through how big of an issue is energy in an overall member's bill, and it's less than 25%. We walked through that purchasing energy ahead of time will help stabilize members' costs. So a doubling of power doesn't bring double-digit increases to a member's bill. Price spikes occur within a month, not prior to a month, often not prior to a month, and are usually short in duration, less than a week. But by purchasing ahead of time, you help mitigate most price spikes that you will see in energy. And then finally, we can adjust rates as we need to. So if in an abnormal event, as we walk through, we can reduce our costs to the members like we did this year, or we could also increase our prices like we did in 2014. Any questions or comments? Okay. All right. So we've walked through the first two sections, and I think we're doing okay on time here. So I wanted to highlight that where can folks go to make sure that these volumes are being adhered to that we walked through earlier? Where's the data, basically? It's great that this is how the cooperative is doing their procurement policy, but how do I make sure that it's occurring? Where can I go to find it? Same thing when it comes to pricing. So we talked a lot about volume today. What if prices are starting to get much higher than what we had planned? Where can I go to find that information? So first, here's another question that we've heard in general is, you know, how do I know that we're on track? How do I know that I'm performing my duty here for the co-op as a director? I want to make sure that I know I'm doing what I came onto the board to do. In board policy B27, which are annually revisited, and B2 attachment E, these work together. These are kind of the framework for this area of the company. And we worked on these areas quite a bit in 2018 and 2019, I think as the committee remembers, where we identified some focus areas and then we developed some dashboards to help show that those focus areas are being adhered to. So that's like the data component of these board policies. I want to walk through those again. This, I hope, looks familiar to everybody. This is our variance report, and there's a lot of data on here. I mean, it's tough. We might need to readjust this again, but it's tough to come up with a way to present enough information to folks without overdoing it. And this was the compromise that we pulled together. And I'm going to bring this report up one more time to walk through the components of the variances. But we provide a lot of information here that is quickly identifiable, but I think it might need a revisit once in a while to see, so folks remind themselves of what's on here, because you get presented with a lot of info. But if you look on the very bottom, I'm gonna focus on the bottom piece here. This shows are you meeting the coverage targets that you said you were gonna meet that we talked about earlier in this discussion? So our forecasted energy coverage, kind of our target energy coverage was here? Did you meet it? And if you didn't, how big was that variance? And that's highlighted down here. And then this also shows, this section here, this shows cumulative monthly variances. Right here, if you can see my mouse, I hope that's coming through. This shows where is that, where are those prices, or where are those variances coming from? Are they coming from co-op power? Are they coming from transmission? And what's the cumulative damage? What's the cumulative variance that we have seen throughout this rate period? And I should have started with that, that this is a rate period look. So a current rate period is most of the focus on this monthly report. But then if you look into the future, we're trying to give you some insight, as was requested by the committee. What does the future look like? Tell us how we're doing in the future. What is your procurement coverage levels in the future? So this one says, if I look at the winter period in November to 2020, and this is an old report, I'm sorry, but the new report, which it's the same concept. It, at this period, at this point in October of 2019, we had a target of 76% for that whole winter period, but we had only met 52% of that so far. So we've still got 24% of coverage out there that we need to do during that, before that period finishes up. And this is showing in October, this is showing how far along are we. Actually, this one's not cumulative, sorry. Okay, but we're trying to also show going forward into different, this, we give you the next four periods to the best of our ability of where those coverage amounts are. So here's a, here's one report that you can look at to see how we're doing for coverage and how is how are we doing for variances. The next report is the one that we have. There's going to be one in the appendix of this meeting. This is one that we show the committee every quarter. And this is highlighting diversity by supplier and shows, again, if we're meeting those annual targets, but it's a different version. It's a different viewing of it. It's on a calendar year basis. It shows you where. Here's your long-term contracts that we had talked about a little bit earlier. Those are the 14, these are the green section. I'm on slide 48, long-term resources. And then, and then if I use the example for 2018, it's 60% was being fulfilled by firm contracts, and we had roughly 25% uncovered. And this chart, these, all of these tables are set up to give you current year, one historical year for perspective, and five future years for where are we going. That was something that we heard loud and clear when we walked through this, when we walked through the committee dashboards last year, is show us directionally where we're headed. These are delivered every committee meeting. So I'm going to pause again. Is there any questions at all yet? Okay. So here we've got another view. We call this one the summary dashboard. It's not pictures, it's tables. You're recognizing that some folks like to look at tables and want to see discussion versus a picture. And this is looking at, let's just pick on the recovery balance. So we talked about over under. Here's for 2.3 million is the over under balance through October 2019. In 2018, it was $500,000 for perspective. And directionally, that balance is getting bigger because last quarter it was 2.2 million. So these little boxes here give you an idea of historically, where were we, what direction are we moving, and where is it today? And then we try to highlight, staff comes together and pulls discussion areas for each of these different focus areas. And that's what these are all broken into, are the focus areas that the committee agreed on. So we try to highlight discussion points that we think it's important for the committee to look at. And I'm gonna continue to walk through these reports again, but this is, there's a lot of information on those. And this one just states the same thing. It's like, well, okay, how well are our how are our suppliers doing? Are they financially healthy? We're paying very close attention to that right now because we're in uncertain times. What about competitive suppliers? Are more folks taking competitive suppliers or less? That's over here with percentage on members, but it's a small percentage, but they have 13 to 14% of load. So I just wanted to walk through some of the reports and just, because we talked about a lot of subjects today on procurement and risk. These reports are put together to address the items that the committee has stated it wants to keep track of in order to meet its obligations from B27, from the board policy B27. And I wanted to remind the committee of that. This is the data that you could go to make sure this is where the company is on the power resources side. Okay. And I had a very specific question about this that I wanted to try to identify. And it's like, okay, most of our reports are in aggregate, but I really want to know what's moving those numbers. Why, what is it? Is it energy? Is it capacity? Is it transmission? What's causing the variances? And we try to address that in the monthly power resources variance report. And I walked through that a little bit in the quarterly reports as well. And that would be in the discussion areas. So if I walk through the monthly variance report, I'm on slide 52. We spend a decent amount of time on these in this section, and it's very helpful to the group, to the team, to walk through these. Because we use these to make sure we know exactly what's going on for the variances. And we can take those variances and maybe those will influence our future month's decisions. And we highlight them in five different categories. So is the variance primarily due to load? Or how much of the variance is due to load? How much is due to energy? How much is due to capacity, transmission, and other? And our goal is each month to explain at least 80% of these main drivers. So this is where we hope that you can go to look and see, well, here are the main levers that are affecting the variances. And we do it in three different buckets. One for the month, at the bottom of the slide here. One for the upcoming rate period, and then most importantly, the current rate period. If this is too much text, we try to highlight the key takeaway of this whole report. So a member can look at just one section and just highlight this. That if you want one takeaway, current rate period costs are forecast to be 8% lower in this example. Okay. So we've got board. So this is just to summarize where we just walked through, is we assess every year what it is the board wants to look at and what is the policy around power resources that the board's paying attention to. And B2 attachment E helps develop what are the specific items the committee needs to look at in order to make sure it's meeting B27. And then I wanted to remind the board of the reporting and the monthly and quarter reporting we worked on in last year. And if those reports are no longer really, if they're not having an impact to help answer some questions like we were hoping they would as we work through these, then we should probably revisit those. Okay, I'm gonna pause there because I think we just finished that section.
Yep. So the question on the table, I think, is, you know, are the reports sufficient? Do we need to rethink the dashboards a little bit? A little discussion on that from everybody on the committee. Anybody have any thoughts they'd like to add? Carol, I think you're on mute.
I have a question too.
Yep. Okay, so who was first?
Alana.
Alana, why don't you go ahead, Alana?
My question is pretty basic. I think it would be helpful to be able to know at a glance in the dashboard whether we've met our volume purchase targets as you presented early on. And most of what's in the dashboard is based on financials rather than volumes. And I know that there's obviously a direct correlation, but prices change. So to know at any given time that we have purchased in the short term, and some of it is on the bar charts. Maybe it's my misunderstanding of the bar charts, but is that clear, Brian?
Yeah. Am I on mute? No. Yes, Alana, I think I can help identify that with you maybe after the committee meeting. I can show you where we're supplying that on the monthly report. We might be the best spot to go look for that.
Okay. Brian, are you going to address that later, or just create an exhibit at some point?
Sure. Well, I can bounce back real quick. This might help. I probably didn't explain this very well. Here. I think the question was, how are we hitting the energy coverage targets that we said we were going to be hitting in those earlier slides? And we meant to try to make that visible down here. So if I walk through this example, let's use May. We had targeted 66% energy coverage for May, and we hit 66% energy coverage for May, and the variance was zero. But if I look at it going for the next upcoming winter, we had our target is 76%, but we're not hitting that yet. We're only at 52%. So a director could be like, okay, when are we've got 24% that we haven't procured yet. What's the plan for that? I hope that helps. And if it doesn't, we'll talk to you.
I get that. It was only that chart, because I assumed that table was based on forecasted costs and revenues in dollar terms versus in volume terms. But if the cumulative rate period or previous period, the forecasted energy coverage is actually, it's a percentage based on the volume targets.
It is.
66% volume target. Okay. That's what was confusing me, because this is actually volume versus.
And maybe we should reterm that, relabel that to be more clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do we have any other questions or any other comments on the idea of redoing or updating the dashboards or something?
Mm-hmm. So we do plan, you know, as Harry's talking about, is we do plan to address B2 and B27 in the next, I think it's the next Power Resources and Access Committee meeting. Might be the one after that, but this is, I think, to cue everybody up. If we're thinking about some changes, and if there are some areas that our tables and our reporting are not getting to the committee, what it is you'd like to look at, then it's a good time to think about that before we get to the next committee meeting, and maybe share with Harry and I some of those ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody seems to have anything in the moment, but if you do, we just ask that you email either Brian or myself or both, and let us know what you would like to see, or any additional questions or observations you have. the meantime, this is where our meetings were, the last meetings in, of the year. Today, we are asking basically the only action is an indication or a vote on your comfort level with including the power resource portfolio and the coverage targets and authority levels in the ERM report for, or the ERM plan, I should say, for next year. Brian, are you looking for a formal vote on this or just a general indication of comfort?
I don't necessarily need a vote. I just a general indication that this is the right direction. The enterprise resource management plan is the right spot to have that. It's a good area for the members of the committee or any director to go and see what are the procurement policies, what are the procurement strategies, and we'll look at that on an annual basis. So that's, I guess, a general consensus on this is if this is the right direction.
Okay. So everybody comfortable with that? Leo? Hello?
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I'm up. Okay. That's okay. Carolyn, how about you? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Leo.
I think that's a good place to keep to put it. I think it should be documented somewhere. I think based on some of the comments and Joan's comments on dollar values as opposed to percentages, those sorts of things, that over time we can tune it up or improve it. But I think it's a good home.
Sure.
Great. Carolyn, how are you feeling?
I'm fine with it being put into under enterprise risk management.
Okay. And that leaves Brenda.
And I'm fine too. I've actually found the update this morning helpful. So I'm okay with it there.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. I think, Brian, we have pretty good.
Hey Harry.
Hello.
Yep. Harry. This is Ed.
I'm sorry. Yep.
Yeah. No, I'm not on the committee, but as the audit committee chair, I would also concur that that makes a lot of sense. It corresponds with our last presentation this past year when Guy was talking about the enterprise risk management and that it should be at the committee level, the various components. So I think this makes a lot of sense. So I'm supportive of that.
Great. Thank you. Anybody else have any comments or questions at this point? Okay. Alana, I'm sorry. I apologize. I just, are you okay with moving forward on this for the ERM plan? Alana?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Oh, good. Thank you. I think you had your mute on there. All right. Okay. Brian, I think you have your answer.
I think that's the wrap up. And I think this is off to you, Harry, with the...
I think unless anybody has some other business, we are pretty much done. We are almost exactly on time. Did I hear somebody say something? Or
okay. Do you need to ratify the policies? To reaffirm them?
I think we can do that. And it looks like we've got that teed up for November of this year with some discussion in August. But we could move it into August.
Yeah, how does everybody feel about that? That's not on the agenda for today. Okay. Well, we can move it to August, I guess. Why don't we do that?
All right.
Everybody all right with that?
Yeah. That's fine.
Okay. Okay, I guess I think we are adjourned. Unless anybody has any other questions. Okay. Great job, Brian. Thank you.
A lot of work there. Thank you.
Yep. Thank a lot of good information.
Thanks. Much appreciated, Brian.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody. Thank you for your time.
May it be Zoom free.
Yeah.